Today is Saturday, April 13th, 2019. This is part three of a Grand Canyon Oral History with Ann Hopkinson, H-O-P-K-I-N-S-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Ann. How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Ann, may we have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Where we left off was not quite hanging on a cliff there on the Biobío down in South America. Could you tell me a little bit more about that South American trip? How long were you down there? How did you get there? What else did you see?
Well, Fletcher and I did a two-month tour, started in Trinidad and Tobago. Just backpacking, staying in cheap places, and so we went there. Then we went to Venezuela. Let's see. Back then, maybe now, I don't know. We used the South American handbook and just picked and chose the places we thought sounded cool. And a friend of ours had done a similar thing, and so we took some tips from him.
Huh, okay.
And then we had talked to, and then I think it was Eric's idea to do the Biobío, and he joined us in Chile. He was about to marry a Chilean woman, Jimena, and so her family hosted us in Santiago and helped us out a lot.
Wow, nice.
So then, let's see, we went to Peru, did the Inca Trail. It was November and December of 1978 that we went. And let's see. And then we did the Biobío, and then we went to Easter Island, spent a week there, hiked around the perimeter of the island.
Wow.
Met lots of locals. That was so cool. The people there were so wonderful.
Tell me more about that.
Well, we were both anthropologists, so we were really interested in that and just... Most people that go there go with a tour, and we kept seeing these buses of Germans going by. even on the plane coming in there, on the flight, I was sitting next to this guy that had tattoos all over him, and that on his hands, it said, I forget what they said, but his knuckles were all tattooed, and he looked pretty rough. But I ended up talking to him, and he was super nice, and he invited us to come to a party right away. He said, don't let any of these tattoos get you out. We'll come pick you up.
And, wow.
And Fletcher was a little skeptical. I was like, oh, no, he's fine. And they took us to a luau where they baked all this fish in the ground, you know. And
wow.
Met all these cool people. And actually, his mom was one of the redheads, which is from the ruling class from way back before they had the war. We just read Tor Heyerdahl's story about his time in Easter Island, and so we understood the red top knots meant they were the ruling class. And
wow.
There were some connections with Peru and everything. So it was really awesome. And then he took us. Well, we just decided we were going to hike the perimeter of the island, and just all through the island, it's riddled with tubes, volcanic tubes.
Okay.
And there are all kinds of caves with remains in there from people living there and things like that.
Wow.
And so it was really fun just wandering around.
I bet.
And then, of course, the statues are, too, and we hiked out to the quarry, and this guy's father had a house right near the quarry, and we stayed with him there. Yeah, we met just tons of neat people there. Everyone was very friendly.
Very nice. Wow. And then, what was the Inca Trail like back then?
It was, we didn't see anyone on it. It was amazing. I mean, we slept in the ruins, and it was rainy and misty, and incredible scenery. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been.
Wow.
And it was really amazing to see these carved steps that had been trodden by people so long ago and worn down, and little things they'd carved out of the rock to get through more easily, to bring fish to the king and things like that up at Machu Picchu, and send messages and all these little outposts for safety, you know, to have if enemies, for people to stay in case enemies were coming. And then we took a side trip to a place called Huayna Picchu. I forget what it was called, something with a W. And it was a ruin that was a day's hike out of the way, or maybe it was less, but we came down this really steep trail, and it was slippery and muddy, and we were just like feeling like this is so hardcore, and we're slipping. And we come across another person, a couple more people coming the other way, that local Quechuan guys, and they're carrying bags of cement on their head and wearing flip flops, so we didn't feel so.
Wow.
Like, that put us in our place. But the apparently the Japanese were developing this thing. They were supposedly going to build a tram to it, but I don't think it ever happened. But we had this huge ruin as big as Machu Picchu all to ourselves, and only partially uncovered. And we just stayed in this room overlooking this amazing canyon.
Wow.
It was so cool.
Wow. That's amazing.
And the water systems there are really cool. And we looked at those in Cusco, too, and where we walked all around the city and followed these irrigation systems that they had. And then in this ruin, too, they had, and there's still even some pieces of bamboo sticking out of these channels to make it pour out into the next channel.
Wow.
Yeah. It was so fun to see that.
That's amazing. Huh. And that was 2 months of just sort of wandering around, traveling on buses and...
Yep.
Wow.
And then and trains, but... And then the second to last stage was the Santiago, or I think so, it was the Biobío, in Chile. And people in Chile were super nice, too. They loved Americans, even though they didn't like our government.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, most people like other people, and it doesn't matter where we are, so.
Yeah, but you'd walk down the city in Santiago, and someone would just walk up and start chatting and invite you to coffee.
Wow.
It was really fun. And nobody spoke English either back then, so it was a little limited, but because my Spanish wasn't that good, but good enough to kind of get by.
Was Fletcher good with Spanish?
No, he was even worse than me, but Eric was perfect.
Okay. Nice. What else do you remember from that trip?
Going across Lake Titicaca was really beautiful. It was a full moon, and it's this little steamboat or something, with polished brass.
Wow.
Guys in white suits. It only held like six people or something. It was really fun.
Oh my gosh.
And then we got to Bolivia. And it was in a state of revolution. And we stayed in La Paz. And, everything seemed to be going as usual.
Mm-hmm.
And right on the hotel door, it was instructions of what to do in time of revolution. And because there had been... 100 revolutions in 99 years.
Oh my gosh.
In the last 99 years. So everyone was pretty used to it. But there was sort of a catch-22, is like, take a taxi to the airport, but don't move from your room. I forget what it was, but it was completely contradictory. But we didn't have any problems. But we did meet, we had made friends with a Canadian couple. You know, the people that are touring around tend to visit the same sites. And we saw them later, and they had been in a taxi cab there. And it turned, and the guy that was taking over the government jumped in the cab with him.
Wow.
And then he said, stop it here. And he went up to the Capitol, and the next thing they knew, they were let out, and they were machine guns, and their crowd was running. It was pretty scary, I guess.
I bet.
But they were fine. But they were pretty shook up.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing.
But that journal, I wouldn't mind sending to you if you want it. But that one's pretty detailed and coherent, if you're interested. But
yeah, I'll make a note, and we'll talk afterwards about some of that.
Okay.
So then, this is in late 1978. When did you guys get married?
1982. We had a shotgun wedding. After living together 10 years, when I got pregnant, we decided to marry.
Okay. had Roger learned how to... had Fletcher learned how to fly by then?
No.
Okay.
That came about... let's see. How did it come about? Oh, a friend of ours got a parapont. Which was sort of the first generation of paragliding.
Okay.
But didn't have as big of a glide ratio. It started in Germany. He brought it from Germany, I think. Jeff Parker, he was a kayaking, he is a kayaking friend, and he had close connections with Prion. And so we took it to the sand dunes and tried it out and had fun, and Fletcher was hooked and started doing it. And then he got into paragliding heavily. It was after, let's see, might have been, I'm not sure when that was. But as he went on and got more and more involved with paragliding and was doing... He worked for Aspen Expeditions, taking tandem flights, and he started taking our son up all the time. And I was not very comfortable with that. And he was 8 and 9 years old. Because I always was aware that Fletcher had a real blind spot as far as danger sometimes.
Okay.
And, so for Leif's 10th birthday, Leif's our son, I gave him flying lessons in an airplane, a real airplane.
Uh-huh.
I gave him 10 lessons.
Wow, when he was 10?
Yeah.
Neat.
And he really liked it. And he learned how to fly. I mean, the hardest part for him was learning how to taxi because he'd never driven.
Yeah. How did did they give him a pillow behind his... behind his back? How'd they do that to get his feet down to the pedals?
He was pretty tall. I don't know. I didn't go. Fletcher went every... I was working a lot. And Fletcher went every time and was hooked. He decided he wanted to learn to fly, too. And he can't... They can't get their license till they're 16. They can't take the written until they're 16, so... And Leif never did follow up, but he has the ability if he ever wants to, you know, take it up. So, anyway, then Fletcher started flying real airplanes.
Let's back up a bit to 1982. You're pregnant, and were you still skiing at the time?
Yeah.
Were you working or traveling? What were you doing mostly then?
I was working, running the Nordic Center at Sunlight, which is 4 miles up the road.
Okay.
And also part time at the hospital. I do cytology. It's a lab work looking for cancer.
Uh huh.
Under the microscope.
Okay.
I was skiing a lot of cross country and some downhill. Yeah.
How did Leaf coming into the world change your vision of travel and skiing and kayaking and that sort of thing?
Well, I was interested that when I was pregnant, there really was a chemical change in how I perceived danger.
Okay.
It was so I wasn't wanting to do. Well, when I was pregnant, I did a lot of white water. We did a high water main or middle fork, I remember, but I was nauseous the whole time.
Mm.
It wasn't all that fun.
No.
And I did some high water kayaking, but I had trouble with it. I couldn't, with my stomach, I had trouble rolling. So I kind of gave up, stopped doing white water, but we started doing flat water after that. After we had a kid, and then we didn't have to do shuttles, and we could sort of do it together, just take turns. Fletcher started taking, from the minute he was born, pretty much, he took him in the snuggly and would paddle flat water. But he'd paddle a flat water boat. He actually wouldn't paddle flat water. He'd take it in pretty big waves.
Nice.
But he'd train every day, and then he'd bring him into work for me to nurse and stuff. And then we started doing overnight trips in the canoe. We just started doing stuff that was just a lot safer.
Yeah.
But still tons of outdoor stuff. And we still did ski touring, even when he was an infant, and just brought him along. And we got a sled. And we were into ski racing, track, Nordic racing. And we had a little, friend gave us a sled, and so we'd tow the baby in that a lot.
Nice.
He loved that. I still have it, actually.
Very nice. There's a saying, I think, that says something like, we as a species survive because of moms. And there's some truth to that. It's really neat that you guys were like, all right, well, we're going to sort of take the danger factor down a little bit, but we're not going to move inside.
Yeah.
Nice.
And the other thing, we did a lot of Ruby Horse Thief trips. That's a nice class 1-2 run near here overnight in the canoe. And it worked out. It was fun. And then just having a kid to share it with, it gives it all. And Fletcher was always great about being content and doing easy stuff. You know, he just loved to be outside. You know?
Nice. Is that something that you would encourage other couples with small children to consider and embrace and get out and do?
Oh, yeah. I think it's really great for the kid. And it was, you know, we just always, after he was a toddler and above, we just made sure he always had a life jacket, and he learned how to hold his breath at a young age. And so as long as he had his life jacket on and knew how to hold his breath, and he'd fallen in a few times. So you didn't have to watch him like a hawk. Although one time when he was, before he could speak words, he was, so he must have been 1.5 or 2 or something. 1.5 probably. I was at, we were at the reservoir, taking turns training in our flatwater boats. And Fletcher was working on the truck. We always had these beater trucks. And Leif was just, had this little four-wheel thing he could roll around on. And it, there was, the water was low, so the ramp was very long into the water. And it had a lot of texture to it from, you know, so people could get traction. It was quite rough concrete. And Leif had just gone down it the whole way, hit the water, and done a flip, and flown out into the water. And he didn't have his life jacket on there, I don't think. And no, I'm sure he didn't. And luckily Fletcher saw him, and he went running down there, and he would go under, and then he'd kind of come up and put his fingers up, because he's used to being held up by his fingers, and say, "Doc," and sink down again. But Fletcher saved him. But luckily, I didn't see the whole thing. I was out training. And then another time he went in, we were at the San Juan. We had two other families that, with some little kids that we did from Algodones near Albuquerque that we did San Juan trips with every year. And that was really fun. And one time it was really high and he, oh, he was used to, we had this little floating donut, floating float toy. It's called a snow nut. And he had been used to playing with that on the, on our little pond. And, but he hadn't grasped the equal reaction physics, you know. If you push on something, it'll disappear. So he pushed on that to get on the raft and went in the drink and started to get swept away. But we got him. It was okay. He was fine. But anyway, what I'm saying is, these little lapses in our security over him were, you know, good learning experiences for him, and he incorporated them and learned how to manage the dangers of swift water and the edge of the river and things like that without the helicopter parent kind of thing going on.
And he's quite the kayaker today.
Yeah, yeah, he is. So is his wife, yeah.
Nice.
And they now have a 2-year-old, and they use the same style of upbringing.
Nice.
They spend a lot of their, they spend all their summers up at the Slave River in Northwest Territories.
Wow.
And they run a big paddle fest up there and teach clinics and guide people. And their son, Davis, just, they just bring him along. It's great.
Nice. Very nice. Did, when was the first time you took Leif down through Grand Canyon?
Not till he was in first year of college. It was his first trip.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So late teens.
Yeah, he was already a super boater by then. Yeah. Yeah, we didn't really, never got a permit or anything. While he was growing up. And he kind of got out of the loop to get invited because, I don't know, we had, we'd turned a few trips down and weren't really in our, doing a lot of whitewater then.
How did you get Leif up on this, up on the slopes to ski?
Well, we worked, both worked at the ski area. And so he just was brought along, and it's small family area, so we could, after he was a certain age, we could just let him be on his own. He'd dig tunnels under the deck and mm-hmm. ski with his friends, and the lift operators would kind of keep tabs on him, and everyone knew him, and
nice,
and everyone knew us, and they'd tell us where he was or how, that he was okay, or yeah, it was great. There's also a big bank that all the kids would slide down into the parking lot just on these chutes, like just on their butts, and
mm-hmm.
they'd spend hours doing that. And then we had a cross country ski club for kids that met after school, and we had a lot of fun with that. 2 days a week, two nights a week. Had a lot of fun adventures, and a lot of times we wouldn't get back till after dark.
Nice.
But parents got used to it.
Yeah, yeah. Very nice. It sounds like a great way to raise a family. It sounds like all three of you were really fortunate to be able to do that.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate. And it was fun living where we live and having it all right at our doorstep.
Nice.
We also, since we were running the Nordic Center, we cut the trails. So in the fall, we'd bring him in his little pack and just prop it up while we were chainsawing. He'd take a nap. And
nice.
Trees would be being felled all around him. Worked out.
So you were clearing the trail for people
for
to ski? Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'd cut some new trails, yeah.
Okay.
And then we'd have to, you know, get the old ones ready, clipping and so
mm-hmm.
forth.
Nice. Very nice. You had mentioned a river trip with Roger Paris in Grand Canyon, and an event that happened at Crystal Rapid, and I didn't want to forget that.
Oh, yeah. So this was a trip. Stories with Dave Garrett, also known as Poncho, and Waldo, who also known, his formal name is Hugh, forget his last name now, but they were the fathers of this family that we did all those San Juan trips with our kids.
Oh, okay.
Really great guys. And they had built their own dories. And invited me and Roger and one other friend down for a fall trip. And Crystal was pretty low, and all the water just, you couldn't do the right-hand run. All the water just funneled right into the hole. And this was pretty late after Crystal had changed again. You
mm-hmm.
know, it changed. And
so this would have been late 1980s?
No, late 90s, I think.
90s.
Yeah, around 98 or something like that.
Okay.
97, something like that. And so Poncho went through in his boat. He had his dory. He liked to stand up in his dory, and it was when he was rowing and didn't even have a seat.
Uh-huh.
And he went through, and he just, like, was like he was on a bongo board. He was just cutting a hole, and he just kept going back and forth. And then it just kind of let him through. He came down. It came, you know, how it pulses, so it came down, and he made it over. And then we went, and we took it just right. I mean, we were straight on and powering through, but it just flipped us
wow.
straight over. And so I was in that dory, and I was under a long time and pretty disoriented. And I finally came up, and I was below the boat, and we were washing up to the island.
Mm-hmm.
And Waldo was on top. He said, "Hurry up, get up here," and he helped me up. And just a second later, we hit on the rocks and smashed the boat up. The bow was broken off. And it wasn't really anything we could do. There was too much current. We could not get the boat off.
Okay.
We tried for quite a while. And so then we, Rosé was there, and he ferried me across to the right bank, and we just camped there in the boulders, kind of made little, luckily we had paco pads, and we're able to sleep there. And then in the morning, the water came up enough so that it could wash, it could get, possibly be removed, and Brian Durker happened to come by with a motor so we could get back up to it, and he helped us get it off. And then we rode it down to Tuna Beach.
Yep.
On the left, and spent the day repairing it. They had all the equipment they needed. It was all full of mud, and a lot of stuff was wrecked. But
I bet, yeah.
The whole bow was broken off, but we ended up fixing it.
Okay. Fixed it enough to row it.
They have some pretty good, what?
Fixed it enough to row it.
Yeah, and make it through the trip. We had enough. Yeah, they have some pretty great pictures of that. But, it worked out. It was actually kind of fun. But.
Nice. Yeah. It's an adventure.
Yeah. Oh, Russell was the other one. Russell Sullivan. He's a fishing guide down there. Lives in Marble Canyon.
Okay. And Hugh... Is Hugh's last
Turner.
Name? Turner.
Turner.
Thank you. And Roger. And so it sounds like Roger wasn't just, don't touch my boat and swim to shore. He would actually, like, all right, well, hang on to the boat. And.
Yeah, he did in that case, yeah.
Yeah.
But it wasn't uncommon on the Grand Canyon to see him on the side swearing because his boat was leaking or boat and something, he was doing a repair or something.
Okay. So it sounds like he had a almost a daily ritual first thing in the morning of climbing up high to get the view.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say in the morning. I didn't see that so much in the Grand, but he was, maybe that was earlier.
Okay.
But I know, I remember even when he was probably 76 or something then.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, whenever we'd take a hike together, he'd always be, oh, when everyone was ready to turn around or I was ready to turn around, he'd go, I'm going to go look one more corner. You know, he always had to go the farthest.
Nice.
Pretty cute. But he did take a fall one of the hikes. On one of those trips and came back, it just blood pouring out of his head.
Oh.
But he was okay. It was just a head wound that bled a lot and got him fixed up.
Okay.
He was a little. Oh, another time, a pretty amazing story. We were camped. It was, one trip we took was very rainy. And we got to Deer Creek and it was just starting to rain. It was raining quite hard, and we just pulled over to camp at the next camp on the left, and all started setting up our tents, and Rosé put his right under a big place where it was obvious it had flash flooded before, and we all said, Rosé, you shouldn't camp there because it could flash, and he just, oh, I'll be fine, I'm right close to, I don't know what he thought, but and it did flash flood. It was like
wow,
the size of the Roaring Fork River at high water.
Wow. Just
gushing over. You couldn't even hear to talk. You had to scream to even hear each other. big boulders flying over there, and we didn't know where he was. We didn't know if he was okay. And he came out like a drowned rat.
Wow.
He was underneath, luckily, inside of it. But he was, that's the only time I ever seen him shaken up.
Yeah.
I had to help him set up his tent somewhere safe after that. He couldn't even manage that.
Wow. Well, that's terrifying.
Yeah, that was really scary.
You know, when you get wrapped up in that.
Really thought he was gone
for a while. What year would that have been?
That's probably that same year. I did 2 years in a row, around 98-ish, something like that.
Okay.
With those guys. Just real small trips in the fall.
Nice. Very nice. Any other Grand Canyon recollections that you can think of?
Not really. I mean, just wonderful times and nothing. Not really stories, you know.
Well, that's a wonderful thing when you get to the takeout and you got to look down to make sure your feet are still touching the ground. Because things went so well.
Yeah.
And that's a real treat.
Well, there have been some trips where people didn't get along. People left the trip and things like that. But I just learned to be careful who you go with.
Can you speak to that a little bit? Not just Grand Canyon, but for any outdoor adventure, how important it is to choose wisely who you travel with.
Yeah, it is important. In a way, the bonds you form when you go through a trial together or wonderful time together on a trip, all the bonds are just exaggerated. That's where I've made my closest friends. And it's just, you know, sharing something that intense makes for a connection that is irreplaceable. But also it seems that it exaggerates differences. It brings out weaknesses in people, I guess, and somehow they seem to be exaggerated and cause strife a lot of times. And so it's important to know that you're with a team player.
Mm-hmm.
Or as people that are honest and know themselves, can manage adversity. That really want to be outdoors, I guess.
Yes. Yeah.
And the ego thing, I guess, is what brings on a lot of the strife sometimes. That there's power struggle between the trip leader and someone else. And food issues seem to be another sore point for people.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one trip we went on where we were just invited, you know, we weren't the core of the circle of friends. And, the trip leader got into this power trip and wasn't giving the kayakers any food, hardly.
Wow.
I'm pretty thin and I lost like a lot of weight.
Wow.
And some of the other kayakers started dropping in with commercials and getting free dinners.
Wow.
I remember one time they brought back a bag of cookies to share. I mean, it was weird. And then some of the kayakers started breaking into the food boxes. And one time, Ponta just made a cake. He was on the schedule for some other meal, and he just broke it out and made it, and created all kinds of bad feelings.
Oh, dear.
I mean, you need a lot of calories when you're kayaking all day.
Yeah, yeah.
And we weren't getting them.
No, that's one of the many components of wilderness travel is food.
Yeah.
And collegiality.
Yep.
And looking out for each other.
Mm-hmm. But we survived.
Yeah.
All worked out.
Yeah. It's interesting today in 2019, what 50 years or so since you've been exploring the outdoor world, what are some of the biggest changes that you've seen?
More people everywhere.
Yeah.
More difficult to get permits. And, I mean, in our day, most of the rivers, at the beginning, we just went, didn't have to get a permit, or even like for Westwater, you just went up and asked the ranger for a permit and got it, and he drove your shuttle practically,
Uh-huh.
And everyone knew each other, and I feel really privileged to have been around during that time. It was really like you're exploring the wilderness.
Mm.
I mean, not really wilderness, but it was real adventure just to go down these pretty intermediate rivers.
Yeah.
Now they have to go to these remote waterfall high creeks, to get that same feeling.
Well, you mentioned even like this up on the Great Slav. I mean, you have to go to Canada, or you have to go to Alaska to try to find those really remote areas. You have to go way farther away now.
And that's what I've done that too. I go up there too with them every summer, just for a shorter time. But
okay.
It's wonderful. Yeah, it's like the old days up there. It's a little town, hardly anyone on the river. Harder to access. You have to climb up steep, muddy banks and carry your boat a long ways and things
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've done a bunch of far north canoe trips. It's really, seems to satisfy something I won't like.
Yeah, it's almost something in our DNA. Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting to think of all the people in cities that have no experience at all about that kind of feeling. Really want their creature comforts. But I also think that's probably one of the reasons that this extreme sport stuff has gotten so popular.
How's that?
People crave. I just think people crave being tested by nature, kind of.
Okay.
And they don't necessarily find that satisfaction in an office job.
Mm-hmm.
Or taking a run on the sidewalk. All these adventure racing type things that are in extreme sports or must be a need for proving themselves or something.
Yeah. So besides the population, which has gone up, do you have any thoughts on just the changes in gear and technology?
Oh, yeah, everything's much more. The gears are just amazing. And when I think of those Arctic explorers and just using leather and fur and
mm-hmm.
I just, it's incredible how tough those guys were.
Yeah.
Compared to us. And because I know you can still suffer even with this amazing gear we have now. And then the expectations on a Grand Canyon trip, if you're organizing now, are so high for the gourmet food and equipment. And it's, yeah, that's one of the reasons I really don't feel like organizing a Grand Canyon trip. It's because it used to be so simple.
Right.
And you didn't have to have any special, all these special meals. I just, oof.
It is different, yeah. Yeah, just, you know, I was just thinking of the stories you told about how to build your own fiberglass kayak. A big long boat where you had to reach way in there. And some of the boats now are smaller than, you know, a human's arm span from fingertip to fingertip. The boats are tinier than that. And there's plastic and spray skirts and helmets and amazing life jackets and power bars, and it's just some huge changes in gear, and of course giant changes in population. The population has basically doubled.
A lot more pressure on all the outdoor places that are spectacular. When Fletcher went on his Grand Canyon solo, he just taped burritos on his deck, kind of thing. Or when we did that, a lot of those self-supported trips, we just took real food, and there weren't any power bars or yet.
And those were in pretty long boats. So you know, I was assuming that they were stuffed from tip to tip.
You couldn't put much in the front because it just wasn't accessible in front of the foot braces.
Okay.
Yeah, just had a float bag up there, and. So, you still couldn't fit a whole lot in there. But, yeah, at least you could take a sleeping bag and a pad and a little bit of clothes, you know.
Yeah, but not
much. But you had to have a beam. Yeah, you had to have a beam to hold the deck up because the boats weren't that strong.
Right.
So that took up a lot of space.
Yeah. When
we
was
used
it?
To do the overnights in our flatwater boats, too. That was really fun on Labyrinth and Stillwater. We'd paddle it in a day and a half, 10 miles.
Wow. And then catch a jet boat back up to Moab then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That was a good training run. It was really fun.
Wow. 110 miles in 24 hours? Or a little longer than that?
Oh, we'd do a day and a half of paddling.
Okay.
So.
Nice. That's a lot.
Yeah. It was... I used to make him stop every hour so I could stretch my back. We did the San Juan race too. That was fun. I don't know if they still have it where we'd run the whole San Juan in wild water or flat water boats in one day.
Where would you start?
Bluff.
Okay. And go out to Clay Hills?
Yeah. I did that once with Ponto in the K2, the flatwater K2. That was at pretty high water. That was fun.
Huh. What year was that, roughly?
Oh, boy. I don't know.
80s?
Maybe. Yeah, it might have been late 80s. There's a guy in Durango who's a big open canoeist who used to be... Nancy Wiley helped put it on. She might remember. So sorry, I'm terrible with
that. No worries.
No worries. Together.
No, I'll ask you about it when we're done here, and we'll try. You guys would be interested to connect up with Nancy.
Okay.
It would be fun. Anne, is there anything else you'd like to bring into this interview that we haven't talked about?
I can't think of anything right now.
Well, if you do, let me know.
This
has been a lot of fun. With that, I think let's go ahead and wrap up part 3 of Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Anne Hopkinson. My name's Tom Martin. Today is Saturday, April 13th, 2019. And Anne, thank you so very, very much.
You're welcome.